Kelman on CliffCentral.com.
Right then, on a Motivation Monday, on a Health and Wellness Monday, it's the start of a new week. It's the start of new opportunities to do things better, to exercise more, to pay more attention to if your heart you think is beating too fast, and maybe get that seen to. It's also time to pay attention to what's happening literally with your ears. It's important. If you couldn't hear stuff, that would be a horrible thing to have happened to you. And there are ways to avoid that happening to you, or to delay the process, or whatever it is, just ways to treat your ears a little bit better. So we thought today we'd pull in the big guns in the form of Nicole Sinkin, who's a speech therapist and audiologist. How's it going, Nicole?
How's it? How are you?
Very, very good. Okay, so we're talking about audiology. Now, I was like Googling before this. It gave me like a whole long spiel. Audiology and an audiologist in a nutshell, what's it about?
So basically, we work from the detection, the assessment of hearing loss, and just the intervention for what to do when someone has a hearing loss. I work mainly with the pediatric population, although I do work with adults as well. And yeah, there are a lot of fallacies and misconceptions about specifically hearing and the pediatric population. Most people think that you can't really detect if a child has a hearing loss from a young age. And actually, you can detect a hearing loss from a few hours after birth. You can just do a screening test to see if the child's the screen obviously says if you've passed or if you failed, and then you can, if there is a refer, the child can have further diagnostic testing, which can tell us we're diagnosing children as early as 1 month old, and wow, actually intervening, fitting hearing aids, starting speech therapy. So, yeah.
I have to tell you, I had the most horrible experience a couple of weeks ago. It's the grossest story. But I was taking a shower, and for some reason, I don't know, I was washing my hair, whatever it was, and I think I put my finger too deep into my ear or whatever it is, and I came out the shower and I couldn't hear outside of my right ear. And I was like, oh shit. So there I go, and I'm like, nah, maybe this is just a wax situation. I go with the earbud, I'm pushing the earbud in, I'm turning it around, and I can't hear anything. So I'm like, maybe it'll be better in the morning. So I wake up, it's like 2-3 in the morning, I can't hear outside of my right ear, and I'm like, shit, this is not a good situation. So that morning, I then went to the doctor. Because I'd been in a secluded area, like I'd been in my house or whatever, just walking around, it hadn't really hit me as much as it did when I was in a public space where I could like barely hear the receptionist talking to me. So in I go, I speak to the GP, and she says, listen, you have, and this is where it gets gross, like this massive earwax buildup, like the nastiest thing ever. And I was so relieved, and like it threw my balance off in terms of just walking around the hospital. And then I had to do the whole thing where they like have to, I don't know, you'll know better than I do, there's water and there's like gunk involved and you
wax
lie on your
removal.
Side. Yeah, wax removal and all of that. And then they pulled out this giant thing of wax. It was so gross, it was like nasty. And then they were like, yo, you need to just check this. And they told me that earbuds are actually bad for you and all of that. But not being able to hear out of that ear, I started to get like intense anxiety, thinking what else had gone wrong. And I can't imagine what it must be like if you're a kid and you can't really even communicate that well yet, what that feeling must be to start slowly not being able to hear something, which is probably why this is such an important conversation.
You know, you make such a fantastic point, because a lot of the kids we see have, by the time we see them, if they are late identified, they've already started developing behavioral problems because they're so frustrated because they can't communicate. And what's actually really fascinating about hearing is hearing and brain development. So what happens to children who haven't received any stimulation? After about 3.5 years, the brain actually reorganizes. And when I say that it reorganizes, that part which is supposed to be designated for auditory, the auditory cortex, actually gets taken over by another sense. So that's why early intervention is so important, because while we're missing out in terms of not detecting or not assessing or not intervening, the child's brain is developing and developing and developing. And when it's almost like if you have an arm and you don't use that arm, that function gets lost somehow, your arm gets weak. So it's really important, because a lot of our kids do actually land up with behavioral problems and all sorts of things.
Let's talk across the board. I mean, being able to be aware that you may have a hearing problem, what does it start with across the board, no matter what age you are? How do you begin to pick up the signs of a hearing problem or one developing?
So with adults, it's a little bit, I wouldn't say more tricky, but what the research has actually found that adults only go for a hearing test about 5 years after the hearing loss has actually developed. Because what happens is...
I didn't even know you could go for a hearing test. Oh, wow. Okay.
So what happens is that the hearing starts to deteriorate, but because they can still hear nicely, I'm speaking to you around 60 decibels now, and your normal hearing is between 0 and 20. So conversation is about super threshold. So you're still coping, and only when the hearing loss becomes more pronounced do people actually seek help. Even though maybe before they knew they had some sort of hearing difficulty, we only see people seeking help when it's
not too late
to say, but when it's deteriorated. Or also people will seek help when there's an active infection in the ear, or if there's an active pathology. So with adults specifically, you can get a disease of the inner ear where there's ringing, there's tinnitus, there's dizziness, there's all sorts of things. And then that can be accompanied with a hearing loss. So
what does a hearing test involve, though?
So for the pediatric population and for the adult population, it differs.
Okay.
For the adult population, what you do is you get into a booth, a soundproof room, and they put on headphones, and they present beeps at different frequencies and at different intensities, and the person has to press the button when they hear a sound, so it's pretty simple. That's your simple audiological testing. We obviously have different tests. There's vestibular testing. That's when patients present with dizziness or vertigo. Then they would do all sorts of tests for vestibular. If you're querying any neurological problems, they could do an ABR, which is an auditory brainstem test, where we get the patient to lie down or to sleep a light sleep, and we put electrodes on the head, and we measure the nerve of hearing just to see when I say neurological, if there's a tumor on the nerve or anything like that. So it can differ from very basic testing, just audiological testing, and then more advanced testing where you're testing the actual nerve of hearing. The auditory pathway is quite an involved pathway. There's your outer ear, your middle ear, and your inner ear, and then the nerve going to the brain. So it actually depends what we're trying to test and what we're trying
to
assess.
Yeah. And for kids in a pediatric space, testing, or how does it differ?
So it's actually such a privilege to be in this profession because it has advanced so much in the last, say, 50 years or so. So with peds, what we do is we have our screening test, and the screening test is just a basic pass or refer. And then that is for your infants. And if there is a refer, we do the ABR test, which is also auditory brainstem response testing. So we get the kiddie to sleep, and if the kid can't sleep, sometimes we sedate the child. We again put electrodes on the child, and we're measuring the brain's, the nerve's response to sound. When the child gets a little bit older, say about 8-9 months, we can do visual reinforcement audiometry. And that's where we pop the kid in a booth and we play sounds and we condition the child to turn to a light, a reinforcing light, when the child hears the sound. And once we've conditioned, we go softer and softer and softer to see the softest level a child can hear. And as they get older, we do something called conditioned play audiometry, where we condition them to take a little block or a toy, and when they hear the sound, they put that block or toy into a little bucket or something like that.
So, I mean, in the case of, you know, picking up that an adult or a kid has a hearing problem, obviously then you've got to figure out the best way to treat it. And that's evolved a hell of a lot as well, right? I mean, if you have a hearing problem or a genetic hearing problem, whatever it is, I mean, in this day and age, it's not the end of the world. There's ways to improve that situation so long as you know that it's happening?
So I would say the biggest advancement in the hearing world or in audiology was, well, is cochlear implants, but not even cochlear implants. How the technology in hearing aids has improved, and you have different, almost like the an intelligence of the hearing aid, where the hearing aid, you walk into a situation, the hearing aid can pick up, is this a situation where you need to cut out the background noise and focus the microphone on the speaker in front of you. But I would say the biggest advance, like I mentioned, is cochlear implants. Mm. And in fact, in the world of sensors, a cochlear implant, hearing is the only sense that one can restore. So if you lose your eyesight,
you can't get new eyes.
Get new eyes. But a cochlear implant, if you lose your hearing, it doesn't sound exactly the same as you would remember it. It's a different sound, and the brain would have to get used to that different sound. But people can, after having a cochlear implant, people can have access to speech as they did before.
What does it entail? I mean, do you take some, what is a cochlear in the first place? Sorry, I really know very little about this.
So basically what we do, it's a big process to work someone up to see if they're a candidate for a cochlear implant. They have to have scans. They have to have a trial with a hearing aid. They have to have speech therapy if they're a child. They have to have all sorts of tests beforehand. Specifically focusing on the scans, why do we have to have scans? Because you have to see that the cochlea, we can actually insert an implant into the cochlea. If the cochlea is calcified, meaning that bony growth has grown in the cochlea, you actually can't insert a cochlear implant. Mm. If a child is born without a cochlea, which some pathologies, children are born without a cochlea, they can't even get a cochlear implant. So what a cochlear implant, obviously the workup is quite a big process, but when we see that you actually can implant something into the cochlea, which is inside the inner ear, what the surgeon does is the surgeon makes an incision, actually drills through the skull, and inserts the implant into the cochlea. There are electrodes that send the electrical impulses to the nerve. And what you're doing basically is you're bypassing the inner ear, the cochlea, which has damage, and you're stimulating the nerves directly with electrical energy. And a hearing aid is often not powerful enough to stimulate that nerve. And electricity or an electric impulse is strong enough to stimulate that nerve. So what happens is that the acoustic signal gets converted through a sound processor to digital sound. Then so there's a processor on the outside of your ear. On the inside, there's your implant, which is connected via a magnet. And then what's from going to digital sound, it goes to electrical energy, and then it powers your nerve, which then sends the signal to the brain.
Wowee. It's quite a process. Yeah, it's quite a process. We're just about out of time. It's been a very interesting conversation. I think, though, what might be a really important takeout is kind of just your advice to people and people with kids just across the board in terms of how to really connect with is your hearing what it should be or shouldn't be, and if they should be worried or they shouldn't be worried, or if they should be testing or they shouldn't be testing.
So what I would say in terms of the pediatric population, when you have a new child, don't just assume that the child can hear. If they're offering newborn hearing screening at the hospital, actively seek that newborn hearing screening. And just before the child goes to school or preschool, get the child's hearing tested. And also look out for things like ear infections. Children with recurrent ear infections are at risk for delayed speech and language. There's also they're at risk for auditory deprivation. If someone has meningitis, whether it be a child or an adult, it's a big warning sign for a hearing loss. So get your hearing tested immediately after that. And also people might know, but in children, measles, mumps, and chickenpox can result in a hearing loss. But just in the adult population, if you're struggling to hear in background noise, or if males are struggling to hear their wives, do not say you mumble. Go and have your hearing checked.
I like it. All right, listen, it's something that we don't perhaps often pay enough attention to. It's worrying to know that by the time you do, you would have wasted so much time that could have been recovery. So if you have an inkling of an idea, it's best to just go and get a test. Nicole Sinkin, thank you so much for stopping by. Nicole is a speech therapist and audiologist. Nicole, thank you so much for hanging out. Kelman on CliffCentral.com.